Ritzy.
Do you love our preparation?
Well, you know, you're on.
Whatsoever.
You're on. That was just captured.
Well, hi.
How you doing?
I wish that the camera had been on you about 5 seconds ago.
Wow.
When the whole window thing came flying down on you.
Yes.
As you were trying to make the room well lit.
So we're in a very cool place today.
Yeah, this is a really cool building, really cool space. And we're our guest probably should tell us all about it, what the concept is today. So welcome.
Thanks.
Well, first tell us a little bit about you and who you are and what you do.
So I'm Lily Chang, and I manage Fuse Labs, which stands for Future Social Experiences Labs. Mm. And that kind of describes our mission. In a sense, we're really looking at social software, how it's changed the world, and you know, what's Microsoft's role in that.
Hmm. Excellent.
So how long have you been at Microsoft?
I have been at Microsoft since 1995, so pretty long time. Before that, I worked at Apple in the research group there, working on a bunch of QuickTime-related stuff. Mm-hmm. And before that, I was a physical architect. Mm-hmm. So I kind of had a pretty non-standard Microsoft career, probably. Mm-hmm. When I started at Microsoft, I started in Microsoft Research, mm-hmm. where I worked for most of my time here at Microsoft. And we created a group called the Social Computing Group and really have been in this space for a long time.
Hmm. Very cool. So what led you to Apple?
Apple was kind of just sort of happened. I was in grad school and at NYU, and we had been working on a bunch of QuickTime-related stuff and design, and so I just ended up there. Actually, it was a really awesome job. I was kind of like, yeah, whatever, Apple computer, you know. And now I think, yeah, that's a pretty cool job.
So. Yeah, very cool. So you run this whole group, this team, about how many people?
So the lab will be about 60 people. We're probably about 45 right now. And it spans three different locations. So there's Redmond, there's Cambridge, Mass, and then we also have a lab in the UK.
Interesting. Any chance of opening a lab in Hawaii?
Well, I was saying, you know, instead of Redmond, Cambridge, maybe we should be having like New York, San Francisco, and London or something. Mm-hmm. But
that's all you. That's all you. Yeah. That's
never know.
So, what are some of the coolest things that come out of Fuse Labs in particular that some of our viewers at home might have heard of?
So one of the coolest things that we're really psyched about is that there's a lot of stuff, but one of the things that we've been working a lot on is social search and real-time search and how, you know, things that people say that they share publicly and, you know, conversations that they have with their friends, links that they're sharing, how does that sort of make its way into search and how do we use that information in interesting ways. So one of the coolest things that we've done is kind of started as a small little project where I think most great things start. We had one guy in our group who was like, you know, I kind of want to play around with Windows Azure and kind of interested in the Twitter API, so just let me like make something. So I was like, you know, sure, whatever, it's one guy. And 6 weeks later, we basically shipped this stuff on Bing, which was super cool. Mm-hmm. And so we got hooked up with the social search team in the Valley, in the Bing team, and they saw some of this work, and they said, you know, well, maybe we could, you know, modify the UI in these ways, and you know, if you guys could do this, we could just ship it. And so that was super cool, because it's really unusual, I think, for one guy, you know, in MSR at the time, to ship something in 6 weeks on Bing, and get sort of the great feedback that we had from sort of the influentials in, you know, in social networking and computing. And then I think we worked with the social search team. They mm-hmm. got the Twitter fire hose, and I think a month later we shipped Bing Now, which is really fun because it's just a very non-typical way for us to work with product groups. It's just sort of this seamless, super rapid, fast-moving space. And it's a really hot space out there in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was pretty cool because we worked with the team in the Valley, which is the social search team, our team in Redmond, and then we had, at that time, the lab was actually distinct labs. And so there was a different lab in Cambridge, Mass. That worked with us on that, and then we actually merged together all those groups. And Ray asked us to come and, you know, start Fuse under him.
Nice.
So the genesis of Fuse was kind of with Ray Ozzie coming on board and saying that we need to have this group together to kind of just be able to focus on that and not have to worry about shipping product kind of thing?
Well, not so much. I mean, Ray is you know, in some sense, the lab was his concept. But we had been, I had a group in research, and in some sense, my whole group came with me to Fuse, or most of the group came with me to Fuse, and a lot of the projects that we were working on came with us. And it was just because Ray and I had really great rapport on the type of work we were doing and the way we were making kind of things happen and the way we were working with a lot of the product teams and the audience that a lot of our products touch. And so he, at the same time, had a couple labs under him, and he was thinking, if we bring these together in a more focused way, maybe we can have, you know, even more impact. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of the concept. I think the concept of what we were doing in MSR focused around social computing. We do a lot of user experience and design, so future social experiences is kind of a summary of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just how can we make more stuff happen more quickly that's more impactful, I think, is kind of the... Mm-hmm. is the goal. And it's been great. So, like, I think, too, having the right backends and tools to be able, you know, it seems like there's a lot of other pieces that are coming together
mm-hmm.
to make us be able to act more quickly in this space at Microsoft. So the fact that Azure was there was really cool because I could have, literally now we have two guys, you know, who are working on our part of the backend. And then we have, you know, obviously Azure just scaled out for us and we mm-hmm. never had to provision a server and... Mm-hmm. You know, that was just awesome. And the search team's been great just because of their focus. And, you know, we don't really have to do the business deals. They do all that. And they, mm-hmm. you know, we've just been working really well with them. So Chi and his whole org has just been super supportive and great. We also have a really great, we have a lot of different collaborations going on with a lot of different teams. So the search stuff isn't the only thing. It's just sort of the thing that's sort of on fire in my brain from this morning. but in a good way. So we worked early on with the Outlook team to think about how you might bring social software into the tool that most of us at Microsoft live in all day long, which is email.
Yeah.
And so we prototyped something called Salsa a while back, which was an early version of the Outlook Social Connector.
Nice.
Which you guys might see. And then they actually staffed a whole team to work on that, and we like sat with them and all their spec reviews and really just... even in Salsa, in our little prototype, they said, well, what if we wanted to add this into the product? And we said, well, we'll just build it. We'll instrument it. We'll tell you how everybody who's using it might use that. And the cool thing about Salsa and Outlook Social Connector is rather than just thinking about aggregating in your social networking feeds like Twitter and Facebook and whatnot, we can also start thinking about what it means to aggregate in private business information that you might have access to. So anything that you share within a company on SharePoint can also pile in, and so you kind of get this feed of the people that you're communicating with as you communicate with them. So that's just super cool.
Absolutely.
Like, it just, that came in pretty late for the Outlook team. I mean, they just really took a risk, I think, to get that feature in because it made sense for their business.
Mm-hmm.
And Stephen Elop and all those guys have just been totally great. And so it's just, you know, that I think just actually shipped yesterday. They made some announcement
Wednesday.
Yes, the
beta went out.
And then we have, like, some other really cool stuff. We built this game called Kodu, which is a game to teach kids programming.
Yeah.
And in that case, we've been working with the
Rick Rash demoed that at PDC in his keynote.
Yeah, so that was...
ago. That was so cool.
So he demoed that. We just did a PC release because it runs on XNA, which has been really great because we can build one in, you know, with one software pass, we can make it run on the Xbox, and we can... have it run on PCs, so for a lot of schools, they don't have Xboxes yet, so so they can run it, you know, in their school, and there's just a bunch of companies and organizations that, it's just a hot topic, I think, how to get kids to be more creative, how to have them be makers, how to kind of light up the passion that they have, sort of obsessing on games, to kind of twist it around and let them create things, you know, has just been really cool. We're actually going to do a little trial at my kids' school, so I have my kids in here, like, make those sample worlds. But, I mean, I don't know how many people I've talked to who want to see this in their kids' school. And so that's interesting because I think with the Xbox group, they're great at, like, giving so many people who have access to Xbox access to these games. You can just download it from the Creators Club. It's
That's
like
right.
$5 or something. And or the PC version is free. And then we can really focus on a lot of the education and you know, the organizations that we work with or that are interested to kind of write curriculum or make it be a little more digestible for maybe a big organization or school. So those are just some examples. It's
very
a pretty
cool.
wide range.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you can think, too, that we have a lot of ways that we can release things. In the case of Kodu, we just released that from the lab. In the case of Bing, it's like a totally embedded relationship where we're just shipping stuff on Bing with the Bing team, obviously, and then, you know, kind of a more traditional product transfer, maybe something with the OSC where we build a prototype, we get a bunch of people to use it, people feel like it would make sense for a lot of other companies, and then we work with the product team to actually figure out how to kind of fast track it and get some of this stuff out. So
excellent.
So that's been pretty, it's been pretty fun. I mean, it feels great that, you know, after only being in the lab for, 4 months, we already have some of those successes. And then, like I said, we have other new groups that have joined the lab, and they also bring with them a lot of projects that are sort of ongoing. So we have some really cool imaging stuff happening in the group, just super, super cool stuff with imaging, large-scale imaging, how you process things at scale, and also the machine learning group that we have in the UK.
Yes.
So the cool thing about machine learning is we just feel, especially if you look at all the Bing stuff, there's so much information coming at people that whoever can figure out how to make that feed of information more personal, more relevant, less overwhelming, more controllable, I think that's kind of the new frontier for design, designing the data. And so having all that expertise just right in the team is awesome. So that's been really fun to kind of partner with different people and kind of try to think about what are going to be the critical elements to make social software successful in the next 5 to 10 years.
Very interesting.
So other than the fact that you're sitting here beaming as you talk about your group and your current job, 15 years at Microsoft, why are you still here?
It's still fun, you know. I do sometimes, like, as I interact with tons of VCs and Valley startups, and they're like, oh, you know, how long have you been at Microsoft? And I say, since 1995, and they all go like, oh, we thought you were cool, but guess not. No, I think I have an awesome job. I can't think of anybody else's job that I would want. And I think that I'm incredibly fortunate. You know, it's kind of a privilege for somebody to say, hey, start a lab and do whatever you think is right. And I think that we, too, try to do things that are impactful, not just for Microsoft, but for, like, just people out there. I think social computing is early. You know, 5 years ago, it was barely around. It was kind of this thing that weird people did, which, you know, of course, I'm one of those. And so it's just been fun to see the space grow. I don't know. I feel like a lot of the work that we've done at Microsoft before, sort of working in research, we did this short stint where I went to Windows and worked on Windows Vista for 2 years, kind of managing all the UX teams there, and really shipping like massive, large-scale, big product right in the belly of Microsoft, and then doing the labs, doing these. I just have a lot of skills that I know how to get stuff done here, I think. And I have a really great network of people across almost all the product teams who are kind of my go-to people, you know. And I remember when I first got this job, I was thinking, okay, who do we want to work with? You know, who are the fun people that get stuff done at Microsoft, and how can we really partner together to make it greater than just views, right? I mean, if it's just our team, we're only 60 people. The company is so big. So that's just been really fun, finding new people to partner with, like Sean, Sutra in the Valley, or, you know, our old friends like Blaze and, you know, a lot of those guys.
Blaze is blazing.
He is awesome. And we did the Bing Twitter Maps with him and his team, which was great, just location and, you know, this sort of beauty of graphics on the PC and on the phone. Like, how can we just, how does that change what people want to do with their devices? It just feels like it's in the, I mean, maybe it's just because I just got this job and I'm still in my honeymoon phase, but it just feels, in a sense, limitless. It feels like we have so many people out there in the world who want to see Microsoft succeed in a way that, you know, I don't think I've ever seen in my whole career here. I've never had so many people say, like, hey, what's happening at Bing seems really cool, or we'd love to see Microsoft do this or that. It just feels like we have an opportunity to make a difference, you know. I mean, we always have, but it just feels like the world is really looking for Microsoft to kind of do something new in a lot of different spaces.
Absolutely.
So this is the Women in Technology series on Channel 9. So since 1995, I'm sure you've seen a lot of transformation at the company in terms of being a woman. How has your experience changed over the years?
You know, I've been really fortunate. When I went to NYU, the woman who ran the program that I went to was a woman, Red Burns, and she is amazing. She's such a driver, and she's such a force that she's been such a hero for me, in a sense. And then when I worked at Apple, my boss was a woman, Joy Mountford, just really a really well-known person in user interface. And then when I first started working at Microsoft, my manager was a woman, Linda Stone, who's also pretty well known. And so, you know, those were just my managers and my bosses. And so I guess for me, I think about it a lot more now than I did earlier in my career, because I have always had such great role models, I think. Hmm. My very first job that I ever had was working as an architect in Tokyo, where I was the only woman like 500 architects and engineers, and I didn't really speak Japanese. And so that was kind of like the, you wow. know, yeah. So that was really a situation where being a woman was pretty tough. Mm-hmm. You know, I was like 20 or something. So so that was my first job. So this seems like heaven in comparison as far as the women thing is mm-hmm. concerned. I have three boys at home, so, you know, it's been a great place to be female here. I have awesome female friends at Microsoft. They're great. I have so many, you know, we're really connected to the other women, I think, at Microsoft. We did a women's conference last year, the first one ever for, you know, women, technical women at a certain level in the company. It was just fun to get together. I think the women are so much more fun in some sense because we have so much in common. And that was really, really cool to see, because in, you know, in some sense, in my day-to-day life, I just work here like everybody else works here. You know, I don't necessarily, being a woman isn't like something that I think about that much. I'm really thinking about how to get this project done, or how do I get this thing to happen, or I have to go meet with this person, or, you know, I want to design this thing. It doesn't really come into my everyday, I don't think about it that much. But I do think it's you know, especially in our space, social software, it has to touch everyone. It's mm-hmm. not like we're just trying to do social software for technical guys, because mm-hmm. that wouldn't be that much fun, really. I mean, I think that what's cool about social software is it reaches everybody. You know, look at the people who are using the most popular tools. I mean, it's young people. It's a really diverse set of people that we're trying to reach and delight in. You know, we have to design the experiences that they want to have. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think that that's got to be our center. So I don't know if you have any other specific questions about being, you know, a woman. And
well, I think that we often hear from people, from successful women at Microsoft in particular, that's exactly kind of the same answer. They don't really think about it. They just come in and do their job and do good work, and that's what they focus on. It's not about thinking about how they're always maybe the lone woman in the meeting or something like that. But there tend to be different styles and different ways, but that's not about gender necessarily, that's just person to person.
I do think one thing that I do try to do, and this might just be a more general diversity thing, but it definitely hits women, is I mentor a huge number of, not a huge number, but I do mentor other women who, I just want people to know that kind of anything is possible.
That's right.
And that, you know, if I can help be an example of that, then I want to be. And I know that sometimes, for me, I run a group. And so, in some sense, in this role, you know, I might not have some of the issues that someone else might have. If they're junior, they're one woman on a big team, their team, they haven't found, they don't have a big network of people in the company. So I think it's really important for people to see that other people can be successful by carving their own path. And I think that's true for men and women, you know, that you don't have to be like some stereotype and follow exactly the path that everybody else follows to be successful. And I do think that you need to be able to define what success means for yourself.
Exactly.
Right? And so, you know, I probably get more people coming and talking to me just about, you know, I kind of have two paths. I can run a huge group or should I be more of a maker? Mm-hmm. You know, that's probably a more common kind of diversity issue that I get. Mm-hmm. And I think, I think for me, I'm like, well, it just depends on what you want in your career. Success might mean to you be managing a team this size and really, you know, having a product that impacts like this giant number of people. You know, in some sense, for me, a project like Kodu, which isn't ever going to make it, because its goal is not to make a ton of money, but it's to really kind of win the heart of kids and have them want to code and mm-hmm. and not just consume information all the time. I mean, I think that sort of is a different. Just depends on what matters to you, and both are fine. You mm-hmm. know?
That's right. So the nonlinear path, which is good, right? Diversity is good. Let's talk more specifically about yours.
So I have a really weird path. I was born in Tokyo, and then somehow I basically grew up in Omaha, Nebraska.
Somehow.
Oh. There's a story there, but it's hardly longer. It involves like some random, my parents ended up there. And no, my dad is not in the military. He's a landscape architect of all things. But so there's a lot of land, I guess, in Nebraska, but
flat.
It's kind of flat. Yeah, it's kind of cold. But I love Nebraska. But anyway, you know, when I went to high school, I had, you know, 1,500, 2,000 kids in my high school, and there were three Asians. My brother and I, of course, were three. And then one black person. That was it. Everybody else, you know.
The flick ritzy.
And so I never had dates ever. And so I just was sort of an oddball. But I didn't really realize that I was an oddball because I was only, 15 years old. I just thought I was like everybody else. Mm-hmm. And I think only after I left, I went to work in Tokyo, then I went back, and I was like, I'm not really like everybody else. But I think that's kind of it influences myself, my identity, mm-hmm. that I kind of am perfectly comfortable sort of being a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And so in some sense, I think it's harder for me to be exactly like everybody else or have to be in a role where I'm exactly in the center and I have to represent, you know, the masses. Because I just, it just hasn't, it's probably just not the way I grew up. I think I could do it, but usually I end up in roles like this one where it requires you a little bit to be comfortable with a lot of ambiguity, kind of carving your own path, some sort of boundary, but then also fitting in, right? You don't want to carve your own path so much that you're just like out there in space and trying to, I love the Microsoft world, you know, it's not like I'm trying to run from it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I embrace it in a lot of ways, but I wouldn't say that I'm typical, you know? And there's probably a lot of people out there who fall into that category. You know, there's certain things that you identify with, and then there's other things that, you know, it's just you. Mm-hmm. It makes you different and that you don't identify with.
And then you went to NYU?
Oh, yes. I stopped at high school, I guess. Then I went to, well, no, actually, then I worked after high school. I went to Cornell. I majored in architecture. Then I took a job as an architect in Tokyo, where I worked as the only woman. In a Japanese construction firm. And then from there, I worked as an architect in LA. And then I went back to grad school to NYU. And then from there, I worked at Apple in Cupertino. And then I was actually telecommuting. We moved back to the East Coast. And I was telecommuting to Apple. And from there, I came to Microsoft.
So how does your architect background influence your technology career?
It was really interesting. When I was working in Vista, because when I worked as an architect, I worked for a really large-scale architecture. They would do, like, urban design. So they would design, like, some giant high-rise in, you know, some interesting place and do all this stuff. And in some sense, you're designing a city, right? And when I went to Windows, I was like, I feel like an architect again. Because at some sense, the operating system has a life of its own. Mm-hmm. Like, you're trying to ship it, but it's a complex system that you don't really control. Like, you design pieces of it, but then people inhabit it and make it their own thing. And you only win if people actually inhabit it and make it their own space. And a city is the same way. Like, you design the streets or you design some buildings, but whether or not the public spaces work sort of rely on whether or not people live in it, you know. And I think the worst thing in architecture is you design this thing that's supposed to be this big public space and nobody goes. Like, that's a complete failure in a sense. And I think in some sense the web and software is the same way. If you design these social spaces and nobody goes, it's a lot less costly to take them down than, you know, a giant public space. And I love that about the web and software. It's very fluid in a way that physical buildings aren't. But, you know, I think architecture taught me to think through really complex systems and problems that are inherently dynamic. And it's really interesting. We just did this social computing symposium that we've done every year for like 5 years in New York City, and the theme was city as platform. Mm-hmm. So it's been really interesting to me to see like location and, you know, augmented reality and all this stuff kind of go back into the physical world. Because when I left architecture, it was probably the most painful decision that I made in my career, because I'm a good architect and I really love doing it. And my parents were like, what are you doing? Why are you leaving your awesome job to, you know, live in New York? But it's all come back around, right? I just think that it's the design problems that we have are awesome. Designing places where people interact online, or designing what identity means online, what you are like, what your profile's like. I mean, it's had so much more impact in a sense than the physical city has had, as far as innovation and things like that, for a while. So.
So can you talk a little bit about, we've taken a lot of criticism, I think we're working on it, but as a company, for not really having a strong sense of UX and design, we're an engineering firm, and that's kind of, you know, what we're good at. But recently, especially like with conferences like Mix, you know, Bill Buxton, people like that, we're really trying to focus on this. We get it. What is your opinion about how far Microsoft has come in that space?
So I have kind of a funny perspective, because I started with architecture, and architects are like the most... they can be very sort of design snob. Mm-hmm. So I mean, even though I made like no money, everybody was in like their fancy Armani suits in LA. We were super hipster. Everybody drove like fancy cars. And my first job in tech was at Apple. Mm-hmm. And people were there like in their Apple t-shirts and barefoot. And I was like, this is so uncool. Yeah. I actually had to go to the Gap and buy clothes. I was like, I can't wear any of the clothes that I brought like in my little suitcase with me as an intern. I was like, I have to go to the Gap. So I bought like this yellow sweater and, you know, some black pants or something that I could, because my skirts were like too weird and my clothes were, I just stood out too much. And so, my first job at Apple, I just remember thinking like, oh my God, the building we're in is ugly, we're in freaking Cupertino. And I remember I talked to somebody and they were like, well, just wait, because after you're here for a while, you won't even notice it. And I was like, never. Well, now it's just humorous for me, because now, like, working at Microsoft, everybody's like, Apple's so cool, and they are cool, you know, but I'm like, where have I come from, you know? It's like, so in some sense, I think the design that really inspires me is still, like, the design that you see, like, you know, I was in Tokyo 2 years ago, and I was like, oh my God, that's a design culture. Mm-hmm. I mean, things there are so beautiful. Every person, you know, in my job, it was so hard to be an architect, because they'd be like, why'd you draw it like that? And I was like, what? And they're like, it's so messy. It's like, crap. I have to be neater. They'd be like, why are you wearing that? And I'd be like, I don't know, you know, or why are you, you know, they're just very, so everything about that culture, is influenced by design. Mm-hmm. And so I think the criticism about Microsoft, I mean, there's amazing designers here. And I think there's a huge variety of products that we ship. You know, so I think when you look at things, especially like all the stuff coming out of E&D and, you know, JSORG, and, you know, I know the design groups here because I manage the Windows design group when I was in Windows. And I have been amazed by the quality of designers in the company. I think that some of the business goals of some of our products don't always require or haven't always prioritized design at the top. So the Apple culture is kind of a little bit like the Japanese culture, but not to that extreme, where every dev thinks about design. Mm. You know, that's kind of in their soul. I think every dev here really thinks about building quality software and sort of how you architect things. We're a little bit more of a platform company in spirit. But I think that's changing a lot. You know, I feel like I have great job security here because, you know, there's so many groups that want to think of design more than they've ever thought of design before.
But it's not just like the token designer. They're serious about this, and they get that. We have to, in order for us to succeed and kind of go to the next level, this has to be part of the Microsoft DNA.
Right. And I think part of it, too, is just the simplicity of design, because I think designers have this really interesting process, I think. So typically in design, what you'll do is you'll come up with, like, three ideas. That's your first thing. Here's your design problem, you know, build a social network or design whatever, shoes for people. And people, the design process is typically, okay, here's three options. And by default, then, in the design process, you have more options that fail that you're not going to do than options that succeed. And that's part of a design education. And I think that you're kind of always reducing a little bit, trying to reduce and boil things down to the simplest essence of what you need. And maybe for me that's more coming from architecture, where you're trying to, like, you draw, they call it the partie, you draw the diagram for what you're trying to make. And it's really easy to stray from that diagram, because if you're designing like a city, there's just a lot of stuff that comes in, traffic and, you know, whatever, some sort of infrastructure that you need to build. But you always kind of keep that model, the model and the picture of the super simple design, like, around, because you kind of have to force yourself to keep going back to the essence. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's something that that's huge in the minds of people in the company, you know, because we have some products that have been around for a long time now. Mm-hmm. And so how do you keep having that simple diagram in the minds of every employee, so that you make sure that the things that you're adding are not, you know, are taking away from that diagram.
Interesting. So do you blog? Do you tweet? What do you do?
I do tweet. My tweets, Lilich, my tweets are kind of funny, because I'm really tweeting to the audience of people that I know that are my friends, that some of them work here and a lot of them don't, who are big tweeters, you know? And so a lot of it is just personal stuff. Sometimes I don't really like to tweet about what we're working on, because I'm not quite sure if, you know,
sure,
if I can. But I don't blog. I don't know why I haven't blogged. I have very lame blog attempts, and my friends give me a hard time about that. I prefer to tweet than to blog, because I'm not that great of a writer, and I think when you think of Facebook and Twitter and status updates, a lot of people, sometimes it's a little bit of pressure to have a blog.
Mm-hmm.
Because you always think you have to have something smart to say or interesting to say, and I think I can manage that in a sentence, but sometimes yeah, it's harder if it's the page. It's the way I keep in touch with all my friends, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
I know what everybody's doing, and it's way easier for me to write one sentence and read a feed than it is to send 50 emails. I mean, I have so many friends out there where I don't even know their email address anymore, mm-hmm, but I know them on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
I see them all, talk to them on Twitter, but I don't even know their email address.
Mm-hmm.
Or for a lot of my friends, if you really want to get a hold of me, you'll send me a direct message, mm-hmm, on Twitter. So I use it all the time. Mm-hmm. Probably my primary way of talking to the people that I really care about. Except like my kids, who think that they're not there. We're not friends.
I mean, one of the questions that I think should be asked once in a while is step back and why do people tweet? What does tweeting and all this stuff really represent? It represents some sort of evolution in the communication. But why, I mean, if I was an alien and I came down and I saw all this data, like ridiculous amounts of information, I wouldn't really know what to make. Can you talk a little bit about why do you tweet? And in your opinion, why is social computing all of a sudden? Because it's not a technical problem. Twitter is a very simplistic software application. Brilliant idea by whatever his name is. But simplistic as far as it's not like didn't require some evolution in technology. So explain in your mind.
I think that for a long time before social networking, we noticed this thing called instant messaging.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people were using instant messaging on their computers instead of email,
mm-hmm,
to kind of in a really lightweight way show that they're around, presence, and to do sort of these super lightweight interactions with people.
Okay.
And I think when you think of Twitter and Facebook, but that's all synchronous. And there's only a certain number of people that I might actually want to talk to and give access to me in a synchronous way. Mm-hmm. So we have the list, which is kind of a closed list. So the people on my list can see me. But I'm not really open to, like, everybody on the web, right? That would just be probably too much for most people. And I think what the social networking did is they kind of moved that into asynchronous space. So if you think of most communication that you have with people, it's they're not synchronous interactions. A lot of them, if you think of the number of emails that you have, like, email is great because it's asynchronous. Mm-hmm. I don't have to be listening to you when you're talking to me. And I think social networking kind of took the IM model and moved it into an asynchronous tool. And then it also adds in just discovery. Mm-hmm. So I think, and this is partly the web, right? I mean, on the web, most people's content that I look at, I don't know them. I just look at stuff that interests me. And I think just that openness of being able to somehow read content from strangers and people that you don't know it's so popular on the web that it's part of the way we talk to people right now. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I don't really almost ever email someone that I don't know. Maybe I email a distribution list and it includes people that I don't know, mm-hmm. but I very rarely would, like, email a total stranger. It just feels like that's an awkward introduction. Like, I know I'm going to interrupt you, and I'm probably going to be really terse. Mm-hmm. And whereas on something like Twitter, I could ping somebody, or somebody can read what I've said mm-hmm. when they feel like it. Like, it's very convenient for the reader. Because if you don't feel like reading your Facebook feed or your Twitter feed, nobody really expects you to. Mm-hmm. So it's fine. It's casual, right? Whereas email, if you don't read my email and respond, I might think you're rude. Mm-hmm. If you don't read my tweet, I could care less, really. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm only talking to whoever's interested. And sometimes people who are interested are not the people that I would expect to be interested. And that always feels like a cool gift. So I'll give you an example. My kid broke his arm. I didn't even really feel upset. He was skiing, cracked his arm. We were in the emergency room again. And I tweeted something like, in the emergency room, you know, Julian's arm. And and like, I immediately got like 6 responses from whoever was looking. And some of those were like people that I had kind of lost touch with. Mm-hmm. You know, my husband wasn't reading my, you know, just the people that I might have emailed. Mm-hmm. Weren't the people that responded. And the truth is I wouldn't have emailed anybody.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like, I would have emailed my husband, and that's it. I would have called him, right? But I'm not going to, like, send a message, email message out to all my friends saying, kid broke arm. Like, they'd be like, whatever, you're weird. Mm-hmm. But on Twitter, actually that really helped me, because I felt great knowing that somebody was listening.
Mm-hmm. You know? Interesting.
And you see this a lot on Twitter if you're on a lot. Like, sometimes things will happen to people, and they'll say, like, God, it's been so awesome to have this support of my friends and kind of this extended friend group. And I don't think you understand how impactful that is unless you experience it. It's just mm-hmm. knowing that there's a bunch of people out there who are sort of listening to you and following you, even though, you know, I have a busy life. I have 3 kids. I have a busy job. I don't keep in touch with everybody the way that I feel like I should. Mm-hmm. But every time I see them, like, I know what they've been doing, and they know what mm-hmm. I've been doing, even if it's stupid stuff, like, you know, stuff that, you know, wouldn't interest somebody who doesn't actually know me.
Right.
And so I just think it's a much easier way to communicate. Like I said, it's way easier for me to write 1 line of text than to send 50 email messages.
So Ralph and company, Ralph is a genius who's been on Channel 9 before, who has done some amazing thing with Xbox rankings and stuff like this.
Right.
Great guy. Him and his machine learning cronies are going to have an interesting time trying to build a way to automatically understand this random streams of people's tweets.
So let me give you some
talk about that.
That I think would be cool. So Ralph, yeah, Ralph's awesome. He did all the matchmaking on Xbox 360 mm-hmm. and things like that. So he built a ton of machine learning systems. So we were just brainstorming, like, what would be cool to see in something like Twitter? Well, for a lot of people, finding mm-hmm. friends is a chore. You could suggest to me people that I should follow, and maybe I don't want friends, maybe I just want to know, like, who cares about my product. Like, why is that so hard, right? Mm-hmm. Today I've got to, like, search and find people. Like, you could just recommend me the people to follow, like, auto-create a feed for me that's interesting if I don't have the
like a playlist.
Exactly. It's a lot like music, yeah.
Interesting.
Let me pick three people and then create a playlist of people around me. And then let me tune it out. Like, don't like this, do like this, more like this, and just adapt it for me over time.
Cool.
I think that would be hot. Or another thing that we've done is, like, look at my feed that I've subscribed to, what I read. Now go out and just show me other content that I might want to discover based on topics my friends are talking about. Show me from the public timeline what else is happening now that I might be interested in. Because I almost never just want the regular public timeline, because there's just huge segments of the population that I don't care about as much as the one that I've already told you I care about. So adapt the public timeline to something that I might want to browse. Or figure out what kind of person I am. I'm the kind of person with way too many friends or not enough friends. So adapt my experience to something that you think I want to consume. Think of email. Mm. You know, some people are zero inbox people and some people have 5,000 unread messages. Their UI today is exactly the same. So how could we adapt the amount of information we're giving you and how we're prioritizing it and the design of the UI so that it kind of matches your personality style or how much time you have to read. So there's just tons of things I think that we could do that would be super, super cool.
Hmm. It's kind of exciting.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, you tweet. One of the things I'm seeing, though, is, like, you know, Microsoft product teams tweeting crap like that and, you know, commercials.
A little corporate.
Yeah, what's going on? I mean, that to me is, like, not that I have a problem with it, because it's good if people read about Mix coming up and Channel 9 videos, whatever. But I mean, in some sense, it's strange.
Yeah, because I think that I think the people that are really interesting on Twitter have personalities. And
when
it becomes too corporate and you're just pushing your product, whatever it is, that's really boring.
Yeah.
And those are the tweets I don't follow, but...
Understood.
But some people, that's a lightweight information way, you know. Some people,
but you know, I love... Okay, so think about it. How many marketing firms are putting out commercials and spending tons of money that people have that exact same reaction to? That's a bunch of marketing stuff. It's it's not authentic.
Mm-hmm.
It's not coming from a person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think, gosh, you know, these people start tweeting and they get that feedback somehow. Right now you don't really get the feedback that like, hey, 20 people just stopped following you because you put another, you know, basically
sanitized,
too much sanitized personality-less information up there.
Exactly.
It's good for people to get that feedback. And I think that anything that's successful, you'll get some of that. I mean, not only do you see a lot more of that kind of stuff, you see tons of spam, you're seeing a lot more bad behavior. That's just kind of an evolution, I think, as things become more popular. People start looking for ways to make money using those tools. But I think companies have a lot to learn. I think our company has a lot to learn. Like, how do we communicate to our audience in a way that makes them want to listen?
That's right.
You know, and I think there's very few people who... ads, you know. I mean, give me coupons and deals. That I like. I don't really want to see... There's only a certain kind of ad that I want to see. You know, how can we make that... How can we make those things that people really want?
Exactly. I think there's a lot of potential there for it to become very specific, to tailor it for, like, the Lily experience and what you look for when you go online, or the Jennifer experience.
Yeah.
So we'll see where it goes.
Excellent. Now, speaking of experience...
Yes.
Mix, Lily,
yes,
Ritzy.
Want to come and speak?
You guys, you're going to be at Mix.
I am going to be at Mix, I think it's the real time panel that Dare's doing.
Right on.
That's great.
That'll be fun.
That'll be a good one. Absolutely.
Dare's fun.
Like in 24 days.
Wow.
So my last question is: so obviously, I would say that being smart is kind of table stakes to work at Microsoft, and when you're hiring new people and you're recruiting out of college and things like that. Say everyone is equally smart. What makes someone stand out? What are you looking for? Like you were talking about earlier, someone who's a little different and feeling okay about that, feeling confident. We talk to a lot of young people on Channel 9. I want them to know that it's okay to be different. What do you look for?
I look for people that like to make stuff, because we make stuff. You know, we're that want to have impact, that have impact. Mm-hmm. You know, that have already demonstrated somehow that they've made impact. You know, so if you made something that people use, that's good. You know, if you make something that it doesn't have to, that somehow impacted people in a way that you can talk about, that's awesome, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be giant thing, because I think most young people haven't created something giant. Most old people probably haven't either. But passion, yeah, drive, you know. It's I pretty much make time on my calendar to talk to people who ask to talk to me, and because I know that those are the people who have, who take a little risk. And they always show up later. Like, they always show up as the person who had pushed this other thing over here. And, you know, I just think I would encourage people to not be offended if sometimes they're turned down just because people are busy. Don't take a lack of response as meaning lack of interest. Just be persistent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think having fun is really important. Cool. Just somebody who I think would be fun to work with, that would bring energy and excitement about what they're doing to the group and to the customers. Important, you know.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I think we get a lot of like, oh, I got to have the best SAT scores, the best GPA. I've got to have like, check, check, check. I did all the extracurricular activities. And it's like, that's a little too, you know, formulaic. You know, we're looking for people who are different thinkers and do different things. And maybe don't quite fit in and standardize like everyone else, and that's the kind of people we want at Microsoft.
Yeah, I think too.
We need more of those people.
Yeah, when you think of like who's made the breakthroughs in social computing, it a lot of those people we might not have hired, honestly, and a lot of the just based on their college resume, or a lot of them didn't even go to college,
exactly,
finish college, you know. And so I think that, but they have made stuff, you know, and they. So I think. You know, we almost never hire anybody straight out of college who hasn't demonstrated something. You know, it's like, and a lot of people, like if you look, yeah, I just think it's important for us as a company to remember that we want those, of course we want smart people. Smart people are, you know, would you want a smart person or a not smart person? You know, we want a smart person over a not smart person. But I mean, it's just, it's not the whole picture.
Right.
We want a really well-rounded person who, is going to make something happen. And like I said, when you look at the people, I think, who've defined the web, because the web is still relatively new as far as social is concerned, they're a collection of oddballs in a sense. Like everybody, and that's probably why we get along so well. Honestly, it's like, you know, they kind of jumped onto something that was really early that a lot of people might have dismissed in the beginning, and became friends and worked together across companies in really unprecedented ways, because they were a small little startup that, or just not even a startup, somebody making something, they couldn't make it all themselves, so they share this stuff over here. And so I just think that that's just a beautiful thing that's happened, that's really unexpected, you know. And I just, you know, I'd love to work with more of that here.
Yeah.
Cool. Right on. Well, this was fun. We'll see you at MIX in a few weeks.
Are you going to show
and
up?
And I'll go follow her on Twitter.
Yes.
She gave her handle. It's out there now.
Did you give your handle? Or
she did. Hand?
At Lilich.
At Lilich.
Which is,
Don't tell them that. I have to figure it out.
No, right on. No, they can figure that out. They'll figure it out. The Niners was smart.
Yes.
And creative. We should start hiring
and
more
creative.
Of them.
That's right.
Absolutely.
See ya.
Take care. Thank you.